Blog Talk Radio.
In Dallas, Texas, on Monday, November the 29th, the Monday after Thanksgiving, when everybody's sort of getting back into the swing of things. We took not quite a week off, but several days off, and now we're back. And this is going to be a very exciting month, you know, the rest of this year, because there are going to be some tough budget negotiations. There is a new virus in the conversation, so lots and lots of stuff to talk about. So as we like to do once a week, let me say hello to our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, happy Thanksgiving. Well,
happy
of days
Thanksgiving.
Later.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving to you. Are we allowed to say that? I want to make sure we're allowed to say that. I don't want to get arrested.
Well, one of the topics that I wanted to talk about today, Bill, was this whole thing about stolen land. It kind of came back. We'll get into that in a few minutes. But, yes, on this podcast, you can say Happy Thanksgiving. You can say Merry Christmas. You can say whatever you like.
That's unusual nowadays. Oh, yeah. Well, Happy Thanksgiving and Merry Christmas. And, you know, it's getting to the point now where you really do have to worry about the impact of even the most simple things that you say. What's going on college campuses is horrendous. I think we have a year coming up of critical political decisions and culminating in the midterm elections, and maybe the most important midterm elections in the country's modern history.
I would agree with that, but I do want to begin, Bill, with something fun.
Sure.
Vin Scully turns 94 today. He's happy 94 to Vin Scully. Born in 1927. He joined the Dodgers in 1950, the radio network of the Dodgers in 1950. But I think he's better known for after the Dodgers left Brooklyn. I think most of his fans are probably in the West Coast. I came to know Vin Scully because he did a lot of postseason games, a lot of World Series games, actually. And that's how I got to know his style. And I think he was... as far as baseball announcers was concerned, Bill, he was like Mr. Elegance. I can't think of anybody who was more elegant calling a baseball game than Vin Scully, Bill.
He was terrific. And, of course, you know, I remember him as a teenager growing up in New York because he was associated with the Dodgers, the Brooklyn Dodgers, which was the one true faith. I mean, we didn't even know there were other teams, but it was Red Barber and Connie Desmond, and then the new kid, Vin Scully. And he was good right from the start. He really took his position, was always, had that commanding voice, excellent knowledge of baseball, a remarkable man, because look at how long he has been in the business, and I don't think he has ever faltered once.
No, I think he retired a couple of years ago. So that, you know, he was in the business 65 years or longer, actually, calling the same team, of course, Brooklyn and L.A. But I just love the way he did it. I love the way he did it. Many people don't know this, and I didn't know this until a few years ago, that he actually did the games most of the time by himself. He was simply sitting there with all the stuff that he had, all the notes and all of that. And most of the time he would do the game by himself, the Dodgers games, that is.
Yes.
And so, you know, he had this great ability, if you would listen to any of the Dodgers games, not when he was doing postseason, because then he had different rules. But when he was doing the Dodgers game, I once listened to a couple of Dodgers games, and Vince would be narrating the game, calling the game, and then there was always like a story that he was telling between the innings, and the story was fascinating. He was always talking about, you know, this ball player, and it was just fascinating stuff that kept you tuned in to the radio or the TV. Later he did TV as well. But I don't know, I just loved him, and anytime somebody turns 94, I guess we got to stop for a second and say happy 94, Bill.
I think we should, and, you know, this is a man who has a clean record and a man who, in many respects, was on, from the announcer side, Mr. Baseball, because he outlived and out-broadcast many of the greats of the game. You know, he came up at a time when we had Mel Allen, we had Red Barber, mm-hmm. The aforementioned Connie Desmond, and later there were other great announcers and other teams, and he outlasted all of them. A remarkable man, and I think that for people who realize that sportscasting is an art, it really is an art, a man of incredible ability. You know, we think it's easy because he's just looking at the game and he's telling us what happens. It's not easy. He, especially in radio, they had to describe what was happening in a way that people could visualize it. And anything they said about a player was, while it wasn't, you know, completely off the cuff, they had to know that. It couldn't just be from notes, because if it was from notes, you would detect it. You know, there would be right. An awkward moment. But these little comments, like what they used to call the color of the broadcast, which is all the little things that were added in addition to the game, he was a master of his craft.
He really was, and I assume he's doing very well. He's apparently in good health, and we wish him happy number 94. I mean, I was hoping that he would come back, maybe do one World Series game or something, you know, just come back as a special deal. But I guess that hasn't happened, and maybe it'll never happen. But I would love to see him come back and do like the seventh inning of a World Series game, just to so that we can hear that incredible voice and that style that he had, that to me was just absolutely elegant. Well, let's move on to other things here. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, please.
I was just going to ask one question because I couldn't answer it myself. Many announcers had a catchphrase. Mel Allen said, "How about that?" And Red Barber.
Yes.
Others. Did he have a catchphrase?
Well, he had several ones.
So.
He had several Southern catchphrases. He would mix some Southern slang with, I've heard that he would say something, you know, some Southern slang that he would bring into the play by play. But I don't know that for a fact. But Mel Allen, yes, for sure. Mel Allen.
How
classic.
About that?
Yeah, he had that.
And then Red Barber would say, "Oh, doctor."
Right.
I don't know why, but he did.
Right. Right. Yes, and Ernie Harwell, if I could just throw another name, who was also a Dodger announcer at one point. Ernie Harwell had this habit, if you were listening to him on the radio, if there was he was doing the Tigers then, the Detroit Tigers, and if a foul ball, let's say, went to a fan over here, he would say, "Well, a fan from Southern Detroit caught that ball." And then if it would go over here, it would say, "Oh, a fan from Flint, Michigan caught that ball." And, you know, he was so good at it, I think a lot of us actually thought that he knew the fans' address or something because he was so fantastic at it that, well, of course, he would make it up as the game was going. So happy 94 to Vin Scully. I cannot think of his catchphrase. I cannot think of one that Vince did, but I'm sure that he must have had one or two. Over the years, I just cannot think. I'm going to have to look it up. I don't know of one phrase in particular. But I do know, Bill, that there's a new virus in the conversation over the Thanksgiving holiday. We have a new virus, and I don't know. This is getting to the point that we seem to have a new virus every 90 days. It's like Elvis Presley and his fame. You know, he had a number one song every 90 days. And I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. I want to take it seriously because it is serious. But on the other hand, is this the way it's going to be from now on, Bill? Will we have a virus every 90 days or every 6 months or whatever. I mean,
I
don't know how you can stop the economy every 6 months, Bill.
I don't know either, and I think the question you're asking is one that's on the minds of a lot of people. How long will this go on? Because the idea of it being in the background, always there, I think drives people crazy. They want to return, this is a phrase from the 1920s, a return to normalcy, and I don't know if they're going to get it. Now, we don't know much about this new variant. Apparently, the drug companies say they can probably develop something very quickly to deal with it, so that would be good. But I think what we need more, perhaps more than anything else right now, is an oral vaccine. I don't know if it's possible. There are oral polio vaccines, but I think what drives so many people crazy is to get, for example, a booster shot or even the original vaccines. You have to go somewhere, and stand on a line and lose working time or pleasure time. I think if there were oral vaccines, something like the way we take aspirin, that would make things a lot easier. But also, I think people should have it explained to them as to why these variants keep turning up for the COVID-19 and what we are in for. It's a terrible thing to bring up. I know people don't like it. But we have to mention the fact that there is something called biological warfare. It's been discussed many times. Mm-hmm. We know that it exists. We know that it can be used. And I think that's also on people's minds. Is there a possibility that this or something like this is intentional? And that can really scare a population. It really can.
Well, I think it's a possibility. It's within the possibilities because there have been in the past, there's been talk of biological warfare, and I don't have any evidence that it is that, but I certainly wouldn't discount it. But the fact that you have all of these viruses coming up, first it was COVID, Delta, and now whatever the new one is, you really begin to wonder, okay, are we going to get to the point where it's going to be, okay, it's another Monday, another virus coming from here or coming from there? And I think, Bill, a lot of people are going to simply, I'll tell you what I'm doing, is I'm vaccinated. I'm taking care of myself as best I can. But I cannot live my life around the virus. At some point, if it hits
That's right.
me, it hits me. But if you cannot live your entire life shutting down economies and shutting down countries like we're seeing now, I guess, in Europe. I don't know how these countries are going to make it, Bill. Where's the money going to come from to keep all of these people at home, Bill?
Well, that's the point. I mean, I think this is the kind of thing that even if we solve the health aspects of it, which, of course, is the purpose of the vaccine, the economic aspects and the psychological aspects are things we've never dealt with before. I mean, yes, we had a 1918 flu epidemic, and, of course, we had the awful polio summers, but this affects the entire world. And if it's going to happen, as you say, every 6 months, nobody can predict the impact, absolutely, but the psychology of this is certainly grim.
Well, the politics of it is too, and we saw the president today talking about this, and I think he probably, I didn't see the whole presentation, but I think he said something that this is a concern, but let's not panic, that's probably the right thing to say. But I think I'm waiting, Bill, for somebody to say that it's racist to issue a ban against African countries, because it was when President Trump was in the White House. In fact, all kinds of quotes from even President Biden himself, or candidate Biden back then, talking about how this was bad for world relations to ban people from other countries. So I cannot wait for a reporter to ask him that question, Bill.
If they can, yes, if they can get to him, if there will be a question period allowed. But yes, that's true. Now, here is where all the hypocrisy comes in, and that is the Democratic Party denounced Trump regularly as a racist and a xenophobe. When he banned the travel from China immediately after the virus struck, as a man who could get us into very serious trouble internationally. And here is, of course, President Biden confronted with the same situation and doing pretty much what President Trump did. But hypocrisy, thy name is Democratic Party. And so I don't think the people within the party are going to say a word about it.
No, I think the vice president said today that this was necessary.
Yes, and that's it.
Which is, of course, the same thing that Trump said, but they didn't see it as necessary back then, do
No.
But you're right about hypocrisy. Look, there's always a lot of it.
Plenty of it in politics today, and it's getting worse, not better. And one of the reasons it's getting worse, and I keep on saying this at Urgent Agenda, is our journalism is so bad. I mean, just in the last week, we have had one of the worst examples of journalism that I've seen in a long time, which is the reporting of that terrible, willful attack in Wisconsin. One network or news outlet, it was CNN actually, that actually said a car drove into the parade route.
That's right.
And as many critics pointed out, cars don't drive themselves. We don't have that there. Have you heard a single discussion in the news about the intent of the alleged murderer? This is usually one of the first things that gets discussed, but this time almost no discussion. Let's just move on. That seems to be the attitude.
Well, and considering the level of crime here, so many people killed, there's apparently 11 children who are hurt by all of this, and so far 7 dead or more. Yeah, I think there should have been a discussion, because the truth, Bill, is that there's a lot of material in this man's background to talk about.
Oh, yes.
This is not like the first time he got angry at anybody. From what I understand, there's social media where he takes shots at lots of people. My goodness, if it was the other, I mean, I hate to put it this way, but it's the truth. If it was a white guy who drove an SUV into, let's say, a parade at Martin Luther King Day parade or something, I think we'd be talking a lot about his intentions, and there'd be probably connections already to January 6th or the Trump campaign.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We would be talking about it for a long, long time, and they would bring in all the spokesman who will talk about how it was a reflection of a racist society. Definitely, there's a double and triple standard, and I think even people of goodwill who want racial harmony are tired of that standard. They want an honest news report. We're seeing what happens when you don't get an honest news report. In the Rittenhouse case, so many things that were said about this young man were untrue, and now we're getting the backlash to the verdict, where the latest being that the university he attends, which I think is Arizona State, even if he attends it remotely, there are groups that want him thrown out of the university, even though he was declared not guilty on all counts by a jury. They say they don't feel safe with him around, or even on the remote learning horn. It's really a very depressing situation, because this was an opportunity for teachers to teach about the jury system, to challenge students in their beliefs, to ask them to explain why they feel the way they do, and to demand that they be up to date on information. And instead, all we get is this politically correct nonsense.
Right. Well, you mentioned something, Bill, a few minutes ago about President Biden taking questions. And he did say Merry Christmas today, I believe, to the media, and then he walked away. So at least he did have that, interaction with the media. He wished them a Merry Christmas and walked away. But he's not taking any questions. And I'm a little bit surprised that, Bill, that the media is not more angry about it. I'm surprised that they're not, getting louder about this, because he does have a lot of topics that they could ask him about, but they yell at him, are you going to take our questions? But then he walks away and nothing happens. It seems like the only reporter at the White House, conference or the press conference that they have every day, seems like the only reporter is Peter Doocy of Fox. Everybody else
seems
to be asleep. It is ridiculous. The only guy that will ask a direct question or some kind of a controversial question is Peter Doocy. I have no idea what the others are asking, Bill.
Well, I have no idea either, and you're right that the press should be outraged at the way it is being kept away from the president, and the way that the White House responds to questions generally. they probably are angry, but unfortunately, in today's politically correct world, much of the news industry is doing its best to either defend the president or to make life easier for him, and that's not their job.
No, not at all. And getting back to Waukesha, I mean, that would have been a perfect opportunity to ask the president or the vice president questions with respect to Rittenhouse. I believe that Vice President Harris, when she was a candidate, went up to Kenosha to see the guy who started all of this, Jacob Blake, I think, is his name.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of these questions, they don't get follow-up on. And then I guess people get frustrated with the media and they turn it off or get frustrated, period. But they're certainly not watching the media, I'll say that much, because their ratings are in the tank.
Well, yes. Well, look, I think, how did we calculate it? That CNN's ratings are something like 1/3 of 1% of the American population. I mean,
right.
that's the readership of a mid-sized city newspaper, and yet they're this great international operation. You would think that they'd want a larger presence, not only for economic reasons, but for legitimacy reasons. I mean, at what point does a news organization become illegitimate? When it presents ratings like that, when it presents such an obvious rejection by the American people, I think people are asking that question. I also think the public is on to a lot of the gimmicks that the reporters pull to indicate one side of the story is preferable to another side of the story. I think the public is smarter than the press thinks.
Right. And the Waukesha incident, Bill, I think If it didn't break the back of the camel, it probably did or contributed to it, because you cannot look at what happened in Waukesha and compare that with other shooting incidents and not see the double standard. I mean, this incident in Waukesha could end up costing the Democrats the state of Wisconsin, because people up there are furious at the double standard. I mean, what I hear from friends and just people that I know up there, people are furious that this man was allowed to be on the streets with, what, $1,000 bail or whatever. So
yes.
In a weird sort of way, there may be some unintended consequences here that may turn out to be good. I mean, it doesn't bring back any of these people who died, of course, and whatever physical damage many of them will have. But it does point out the double standard, Bill.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I wonder how African-Americans feel about that double standard. You know, one of the things about the alleged killer in this horrible incident is that he had hurt his own community. He ran over a woman of color and injured her severely. I think it was his girlfriend. Fortunately, she survived. But, I mean, there has to be a recognition that when the system, including the journalistic system, is soft on crime, that it's going to affect these poor communities very badly, because those criminals go back into those communities, and that's where they usually commit most of their crimes.
That's right, and it's people like this man who is driving the SUV, and the fellow in Kenosha who started all of this, who was actually going to his girlfriend's house or some girl's house and was threatening to attack her. And that's how the police got involved, because she called the police. I mean, the victims in both of those were black women in both of those cases.
That's exactly right.
And you have
exactly
to wonder,
right,
you know, how the community feels. I mean, because, you know, the people who live in those communities, they're terrified by men like these. Because the victims, they don't always make it to TV, of course, because that's just the way it is, but they are victims nevertheless, Bill.
Yes. They are very much victims, especially young mothers who have lost children in these communities, and they never get any real attention by the press, including the press that considers itself woke. For some reason, the African-American mother who lost a child is invisible. For some reason, African-Americans who are preyed on within their communities by criminals, they tend to be invisible. The only time we hear from anyone about this is individuals who are called leaders. They're called leaders. They aren't necessarily elected by anybody, but the press assigns them the rank of leader, and they explain the whole thing. You know, and it really isn't much of an explanation at all.
That's right. Bill, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, I want to get into one big issue that will be facing the country here in the next couple of weeks, and that's the debt limit debate coming up. So we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, as we like to do once a week, chatting with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, I want to ask you a quick question about Thanksgiving. I should have brought it up before, but I forgot. When you were growing up, did your family mix some ethnic food with Thanksgiving? Because we do. You know, my mother would always add some Cuban dishes to the table. Did your family do the same thing?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Now, I'm doing this from memory, and memory can be very deceptive, but I believe that the big thing was the turkey and the stuffing. That was the big thing to me, the turkey. But I don't recall any ethnic or particularly New York foods. I think it was that we had traditional Thanksgiving dinners. They weren't very large. We didn't have a very large family. And it was a completely accepted holiday. You didn't have the political challenges to it today that we had then. You had your dinner. The young people in particular liked it. And then afterwards, you went on with your life. But no, I don't recall any ethnic twist to it.
Yeah, I know that many families do, particularly immigrant families do. They have the turkey.
Yes.
They have the traditional, but then they always mix in some of their family dishes, you know, just to remember that. Now, you mentioned Thanksgiving. There is the stolen land argument came back into conversation over the Thanksgiving week. Bill, I think that these people represent such a small number of Americans that it amazes me that they get as much attention as they do. I mean, they're treated like they're speaking for millions of Americans, even millions of Native Americans, and I don't think they do. I think these are isolated people. These are freaky people who at one time you would run into people like this in the old cable access channels. Remember that back in the 80s before became huge?
Yes.
Every city had this cable access channel, and they could rent or give you for free time at 2 o'clock in the morning. And that's when people like this would go and talk about all their conspiracies and theories. But now they're treated by the media like they speak for people. And, Bill, I don't think they do. I don't have any evidence of it, but I just don't think a lot of Americans are sitting around, Native Americans sitting around saying, gee, what a mess. We're eating turkey on stolen land. I just don't feel that way, Bill.
I think you're absolutely right. Look, there is resentment on the part of Native American groups that their history is sometimes distorted and made into something that it isn't. I can understand that. As far as it being stolen land, if some of these people who constantly use that theme think it's really stolen land, why don't they personally leave and say, I don't want to live on stolen land. I wanted to go back to the original people. But they never make any sacrifice themselves. It's just, you know, the talk. Look, there is a history. There is a history of the pilgrims coming, of other colonists coming to America and settling here. My feeling has always been, as long as they came here and settled peacefully, that they had a right to be here. I mean, where is it written that only indigenous peoples have a right to live in a particular place? This is a huge continent. And I believe that the number of Native Americans at any one point, the largest number, was about 13 million, which is, you know, kind of like the size of New York. There was certainly plenty of room, it still is, for other people to come. Now, if there were cases of colonists coming and engaging in acts of aggression or displacement against people, yes, that should be taught. It should be, and regret should be expressed, and maybe help should be given. I mean, where appropriate. But the way many of the people who bring these things up are people who don't like this country to begin with. They really are anti-American Americans, and they want to disparage everything the country does or ever has done. And they have this thing about Native Americans, but as I said, they never make any sacrifice themselves. They also are the kind of people who like to go to international meetings and denounce their own country. I think we can come to, in a way, a settlement by saying, yes, there were injustices done to indigenous peoples when the colonists came over. But they certainly, a lot of it wasn't intentional. People say, well, Columbus brought germs with him or bacteria or disease. He probably did, and his followers probably did, but it was not done intentionally. They didn't know anything about that kind of thing in 1492. And I think we should say, look, we're going to live together in this territory. We'll give a helping hand to Native Americans if they want it and ask for it, and we will treat them as equal citizens. And that's the best we can do. I don't know what more we can do. You know, people say, right. Well, how about reparations? Well, we do that in the form of social programs, and then it is up to the people of those particular ethnicities to seize on those programs and use them for their own betterment. You know, one of the things about the issue involving Native Americans, and I don't say this in any way to disparage Native Americans, because they were not a perfect people any more than the colonists were perfect people.
Right.
There were wars among them. There were atrocities among them. And I think that we have to come to some historical settlement, an admission that there were some injustices, an admission perhaps that there were some injustices on the other side, attacking colonists who meant no harm to these people, mm-hmm. and go on with our lives and try to be good to each other and to help each other. I don't think we can go beyond that. I really don't.
No, I don't think so either. I think you're right. And the question is, for example, where I'm sitting right now here in my home office, is this stolen land? And if it is, who am I going to give it back to? It's my land. It's
That's
my
right.
property. You know,
That's
I didn't
true.
Steal it from anybody. I mean, most of this, I think when they talk about aggression against the Native Americans, a lot of it, I think, happened in the Southwest, where we are, Texas, because that's where I think there were more Native American tribes that confronted the U.S. Army, and there was more fighting and so on. I don't think it happened that much in other parts of the country. I think most of those Native Americans in other parts were more peaceful people who coexisted, as far as I can tell. But yes, here in the Southwest, and even really more into Mexico, there was some very tough fighting that went on. But it happened. I'm not sure that any of it can be fixed 200, 300 years later, Bill.
I think that's true. I mean, we can't take back the history. We can only help people to a reasonable degree who have perhaps been hurt by that history. But we cannot repair the damage done to every group in the world hundreds of years ago, because we'd be including
right.
just about everyone. You know, you can go into countries that we regard as civilized. Well, they've done terrible things. But if you look at the comments made by these cause seekers who disparage the United States as stolen land, you know, they will bring up the Native Americans one day, and then they'll bring up another group, and then another group after that. And they are creating an image, especially for young people, of a terrible country where terrible people did terrible things to people who were peaceful, and that was about it. That's not the whole story. It's not the whole story of America. This is a country where a lot of people came and did wonderful things and built a great nation, and did not have any intent to harm anyone.
And in many cases, they didn't. In fact, what they left behind, these great people that came here, they left behind a rule of law and a constitution that makes it possible for many of these critics of the United States to criticize the country openly. I don't
think that Geronimo
or Moctezuma would have been very tolerant of people criticizing how they got their land. I mean, many of these Indian tribes actually got their land by fighting others. So they give you this romantic image of the, you know, that North America was like Wisconsin Dells. I don't know if you've ever been to Wisconsin Dells, where they have these communities of Native Americans peacefully all dressed up in these pretty outfits. That wasn't true either. That's not the way it was. But my feeling is, like you were saying, Bill, let's forget about the past and let's deal with the present. I don't know of a single Native American kid living in the country right now who's going to get a better education because of all this talk about reparations. I don't know of a single one who's going to be better off next week. I think a lot of these are opportunists. I think you're right. I think they hate the country, and that's what it's really driving it. They just hate the country. That's what it is. I'm convinced of that, and as far as I'm concerned, we can do a collection and send them wherever they want to go.
I think that's true. The America hating is something that the press never really talks about. They talk about people who are protesting. They talk about people who have a grievance against somebody, but they never talk about the fact that they often come from groups or are influenced by groups who really do hate the country. And there are people like that in America. There always have been. I mean, after all, we fought a civil war. In the 1800s.
Right.
And we certainly have had in the last 60, 70 years a leftist movement in this country that, I'm not referring to liberals now, but to leftists, that is really very anti-American. They reject the Constitution. You know, they call it a document written by dead white men. They reject any culture other than indigenous cultures. They reject freedom of speech, very much so, and in fact they are a danger to freedom of speech, and they want a completely different country. They want a jury trials that are not held to determine guilt or innocence, but are held as show trials, which is the kind of thing you had in the old Soviet Union, to teach people the right way to think. Well, most Americans don't agree with that approach, and I think that's
we
have this great tension in the country, and I believe that much of the tension is created by a press that refuses to tell us completely what some people believe.
Right, and they don't present the whole story, like you were saying before, about the building of North America. Bill, several other things I wanted to get into today, but I want to. It is actually 10 months since President Biden and Vice President Harris took over, and things are not going very well for them if we look at the polling data. But this week could really be the tough week because there is a debt ceiling, I guess it has to be decided by Friday, I believe. And it looks to me like the Republicans are not going to play this time, that they're not going to go along with it unless they extract some major conditions from the White House. At least that's the sense I have. Is that what you're thinking, Bill?
Sylvia, my set just break up on my set. Would you just repeat the last part of the question?
No. What I said was that it's 10 months. The Biden-Harris administration is 10
that's
months old.
That's what I got. Yes.
Yeah, and the polling data is not good. And this may be the toughest week yet because this week we have to do something about the debt limit, and I said that I think it's going to be very tough because the Republicans sound like they're very united on this, and they're going to probably extract some conditions from the Biden administration, but I don't know if they can negotiate. So I just see this week in particular ending in a very controversial way, Bill. I guess that's what I was trying to say.
Well, thank you for repeating that. I've got the whole thing now. The issue here is that the Democratic Party is not united. Remember, they are still the majority party in both houses of Congress, if only by a small number of votes. But they have this extremist wing that is incredibly demanding and doesn't want to negotiate over anything. anything. I mean, once it was recognized after the Virginia result in the primaries that they were losing the battle for public opinion, they came right back the next day with exactly the same position. No change, no concession, no nothing. And so you have a majority party that is fractured, and fractured in such a way that a minority within that party makes it impossible for the majority of that party, the Democratic Party, to negotiate professionally. That's the one thing you've got. The other thing you've got is, as you pointed out, you have an executive administration led by the president that is intensely unpopular. So I think you're exactly right. There's going to be a clash. Now, the key question here is whether the Republican Party is expert enough and skillful enough to not only negotiate but campaign at the same time, saying in effect to the American people, we cannot go on like this. You must change leadership of Congress in the next election. I cannot see that much getting done in the next year until the 2022 elections, because I think they're going to be decisive, and the country may itself not be that divided, but the politics of the country are that divided. And I don't see any way for Mr. Biden to increase his popularity. There's nothing in the gift box of the Democratic Party that is so popular that it can be used to increase his popularity. In fact, quite the contrary, especially on things like gasoline prices, the administration basically is doing very little and is kind of saying, well, you have to accept this because we're looking for a better future. And Americans are going to that gas pump and realizing all they're giving up for $5 a gallon gasoline, and they are angry, and probably so.
Right, and then, of course, the Secretary of Transportation, in what has to be one of the most idiotic things that I've heard in quite some time, said that, well, if you drive electric cars, you don't have to worry about gasoline prices. Well, somebody should tell the Mr. Secretary that an electric car is like $50,000, and that I don't think we have enough power facility at the moment to have 300 million cars running on electricity. So, I mean, this is such an idiotic statement on the part of the secretary, but I guess that's what you get from this administration. But you wrote a really interesting post this week here, the last couple of days, about energy costs going up, and I think in Pennsylvania was your post.
Yes.
But this is going to happen
in
other places. I mean, New York, where you live, this is going to happen too. And when that starts going up, my goodness, I mean, the costs are going to be, I don't know how families are going to make it, Bill.
Well, the one on Pennsylvania was the projection that energy prices, and by that we mean beyond gasoline. We're talking about energy to heat homes, to run equipment, the cost of electricity to run your home. The energy prices may go up as much as 50%, 50%.
Wow.
Now, when that happens, how are they going to explain that to the American people? Well, they're going to lecture the American people and say, you must accept this. This is the cost of having a green future, and if you don't pay this price, the world will come to an end, because we have it on authority from Little Evita of the Bronx that the world is going to come to an end. And I think she's packing already, you know? That's what they do. They scare you, and they shame you that you should be proud to pay these prices, because look at all the good that's going to come from it. I don't see any good coming from it immediately. We don't have green energy, and we don't really have a car fleet that is capable of being run entirely on electricity. As you said, we don't have the charging stations. We don't have the technology. The batteries are not good enough, really, for general use. And we also have issues, as I understand it, of the production of these vehicles with their batteries, and whether it will result in more pollution than what we have now. And it may very well.
Yeah. No, and it's just amazing to me. They're explaining, you're right, they're explaining the higher cost by saying, well, feel good that you're paying $4 for gasoline. Feel even better that you're paying 50% more energy. You're contributing to the Green New Deal. And I think a lot of Americans are, the only Green New Deal that they're worried about is the money going out of their wallets, Bill. That's the green that they're thinking about. And I can speak for myself. I mean, it's $3.19 every week you and I compare the price. It's $3.19 in Texas. And that's unheard of, Bill. I have not seen gasoline that expensive in Texas since I've lived here, since 1984, Bill. So $3.19, I'm sure it's more than that in New York.
Oh, I go to some stations, depending on where I am, where it's over $4. And people,
wow.
and add to that, remember, the fact that inflation is driving up the cost of food, another basic necessity. Inflation, as some economists have pointed out, is basically a tax. It's not a tax
mm-hmm.
levied by the government, but it's a tax levied on the consumer. And it especially is hard on poorer families, the very people the administration claims it wants to help. They're going to have to pay these prices when they can get the merchandise, because added to all of our problems in terms of inflation and high gas prices is the fact that some products are not gettable in some places because we have a transportation problem that our Secretary of Transportation does not know how to solve. We have a trucking problem. We're short about 80,000 truck drivers. There are goods stacked up in our ports that cannot be delivered. And to boot, as I understand it, and I have only general knowledge of this, there are provisions in the bill that was passed and accepted a few weeks ago, the infrastructure bill, that bar some port facilities from improving their abilities. I don't know what the reason for that is. It is probably to satisfy labor unions, but there is material in that bill that will make it impossible for us to improve the very ports that are being jammed at the moment and need improvement. That's
right.
That is, for a civilization, that's the beginning of suicide.
Right. Well, and one more thing I'll say about energy, and then I want to talk a little bit about the crime in the cities. Some of these cities are experiencing some terrible crime problems. But one more thing that I'll say about energy. One of the benefits of having a man like Donald Trump in the White House is that I think he understood the relationship between cheap energy and the middle class. That if you're a middle class family and you were paying $2.20 for gasoline a year ago, and you're paying $3.20 now, that dollar difference really hurts the middle-class family. I'm not talking about the well-to-do. The very well-to-do don't have to worry about gasoline prices. They never have. But it's the middle class, because they're more than likely to be the ones who drive to work. We have something very interesting in Texas where we have lots and lots of companies that like cut the grass and do landscaping. And all of them have little trucks that they use. I assume it's probably true anywhere else. And those trucks, I mean, that business, I was talking to the fellow who works in our landscaping, or cuts our grass, and I was talking to him about 2 weeks ago, and he was saying that it's getting harder and harder for him to break even with the cost of gasoline. Because, you know, when you go from $2.20 to $3.20, that's a tough thing when you got to put 20 gallons in a tank, Bill.
It's a tremendous thing. I mean, gasoline is not only a basic necessity, it's in your face every day. It's in your face when you, not only when you go to the gas pump, but when you watch the gas gauge in your car. You go to work, maybe you go 20 miles, you see that gauge going down and down, and you know that is your money being spent. And you also know that when Trump was in office, I don't recall the exact figure of what a gallon of gas cost, but it's gone up and up and up. It's going up further, and the energy for the home is going up further. You know, it's going to reach the point, if it hasn't already, where the average American family will be going around shutting out lights and living in partial
right.
darkness, simply to save energy money, and that's exactly what's going to happen.
That's right. No, you're right. I think also with the heater. I wouldn't be surprised if homes are, you know, in the winter up in the north, actually lower the temperature more in their homes and wear sweaters and so on.
Oh, yes.
Because, you know, they cannot pay the bill. One last topic I want to get into, Bill. It's a very complicated topic, but we're seeing this now in many cities where we're seeing these attacks on stores, on shopping centers. I think San Francisco was one case, Philadelphia another case,
yes.
Los Angeles
Chicago.
Another case. They seem to be striking expensive stores. They're not going after Woolworth or that type of thing. They're going after the expensive stores. And the police is frustrated because, you know, it's hard to catch these people. I think this is another problem for the Democrats. And a lot of times, you know, people look back at the election in Virginia and the election in New Jersey. I think the election in New Jersey is the one the Democrats ought to be worried about, because people, I think, express themselves not just about the cost of energy, but about these attacks on stores and the inability of a city like Philadelphia, for example, to protect its citizens, Bill.
That's exactly right. And many of these cities, as you know, are influenced by the election of woke district attorneys, many of them financed by a man named George Soros. He's a hard left, a very rich guy who contributes to these campaigns. And so you have a situation, and we've seen it in large cities, where the police, first of all, are reluctant to do anything, because if they look at somebody the wrong way, they'll be charged with brutality, where many of the protections that police enjoy, immunity in some cases, have been removed. They're also afraid of their own lives, that the anti-police attitude in some communities has now grown so bad that a policeman going off to work really is in serious danger of his life every moment of every day. And also the fact that they will tell you, you put somebody in prison or arrest that person for robbing a store, and that person is out on the street within an hour. Because of the left-wing politics that dominate many of these large cities, they don't believe in keeping people in jail. They believe in what they call redemptive justice and restorative justice and all kinds of lingo. It has been a disaster. It will continue to be a disaster. The problem is that very often even Democrats who have more common sense and want to correct the problem are being forced by their political parties not to. Very bad situation for the Democrats. The Republicans have an ideal situation next year. Let's see if they know how to exploit it.
That's right. But I think that when you're talking about crime like the ones we're seeing on television, where you have stores that are being looted by these people, and they all seem to be having so much fun doing it, Bill. You know, that's the part. I mean, you watch these people breaking stores and stealing things, and it's like one gigantic party. I mean, it's like the Lakers won the NBA title or something. You know, it's absolutely crazy. There's no sense of, you know, you look at these people, you know, they don't even hide from the camera. They want the camera to see their face. Maybe they're going to put it on Facebook or Instagram later in the day or whatever. And I think people look at that and they say, well, this is too much. You know, this is way too much. And I have to believe a lot of African Americans look at that and they say, no. That's crazy. That's killing us. It's killing our communities.
Absolutely. And also, you made the point a few minutes ago that I thought was very good. They are robbing upscale stores. Well, now of course, right. We should explain that every poor child in America needs a Louis Vuitton bag. Because how can you go to school, I mean really
right.
now, really, and face your neighbor without a Louis Vuitton bag, and especially if you're already a mature five-year-old? I mean, I understand
right.
what they want. I mean, it's just respectability. But you know why they're stealing these things? To resell them. I mean, that's
right.
You get a lot of shrinkage. But I know that stores have now begun to really complain about what this is costing them. The police won't take any action, but I think there was a statement made by Best Buy that its margins are being cut by this horrible behavior. And, of course, we also have the politically correct crowd, which has now come in and said you can't call it looting.
Right.
It's not that looting, that calling it looting is racist, that it really isn't looting. And so I have to be very careful about what I say, because maybe we should call it permanent borrowing. Maybe we should call it attempts to clean stores. You
right.
know, remember that back when I lived in Chicago, there were some people, and they had a good point in a way. When they would redevelop neighborhoods, they would do it rather roughly. You know, the people who lived there were told to, you know, complete their leases and leave. And there was a phrase that some on the left used it. This is in the early 1960s, that urban renewal was, using the language of the time, urban renewal was Negro removal. And to a degree, it was true. And to a degree, sure. That was its purpose. These were rough operations. What we're getting now, though, is this elegance. I mean, going up to Michigan Avenue in Chicago, going into the stores, I think we're going to get the kind of looting in the next few weeks where if the store doesn't have an item, that the looter will be able to order it.
Right. Or file a complaint. Go to customer service
and say,
you don't have what I want to steal.
Yes, you don't have the coat that I was looking for. May I order it? And I'll loot next week, and I'll give you the little certificate, and I'll have it. I think you may get that, but we're getting pretty close to that, Bill,
because
yes,
it's chaotic. What we're seeing is the kind of chaos that brings about a backlash. That's what I think we're seeing. This is no longer about a march against. Whatever. This is the kind of stuff that people are going to get hurt. And, I've seen some of these videos of these people going into these stores, and it's like, my God, there's no shame. It's all, it's we own it.
Absolutely.
We deserve it. And that's not a healthy society.
And to see mobs of these kids and then getting into their cars, taking the merchandise and getting into their cars. And just going and knowing, I think in Los Angeles, San Francisco, the idea is I think if you steal less than $900 of merchandise, they don't put you in prison. So there's no penalty. So why not do it? Just a terrible
situation. Why not do
situation.
It? And it's creating. It is. It's horrible, and it's happening in a lot of our cities, unfortunately, Bill.
Yes.
And it all falls back on the kind of leadership. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead, Bill. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, if you see people stealing milk and bread, you say, all right, it's wrong, they have to be stopped, but it's obviously for their families. But when you see them stealing a Louis Vuitton bag or a Porsche, or one of the better suits at Nordstrom, from better dresses, there, I think the any sympathy stops. I really do.
Well, when they start stealing electric cars, Bill, so that they don't have to worry about gas prices, then we will know that the circle is complete. steal a Tesla because you don't have to worry about gas prices. And, Bill, as always, thank you so much for your time. We've got a lot to look forward to next week, especially that issue in the Congress with the debt limit. That's something I'll keep an eye on Urgent Agenda this week to see what you're reporting on that. But that's going to be a big one coming up. And I'm sure we'll talk more about crime in the city because it is out of control in many of these cities, Bill. But as always, thank you for your time and enjoy yourself. I hope you have a few turkey leftovers for this week. And let's do it again next week.
That's exactly right, Silvio. I look forward to next week. Right now, as soon as I finish the broadcast, I'm going over to the local mall to see what I want. I've been given a budget by the court. The court has given me a budget, and let's see what they have.
Let's see what they have. You go look at the richest stores around you and see what they have, Bill. You may need it.
Of course. Absolutely.
You may find some people who are willing to volunteer to do it for you, Bill.
Maybe they can help me as I try on the goods.
That's right. Have a great week, Bill. We'll talk to you later.
Same to you, Sylvia.
Thank you so much. Our good friend, Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda, always enjoy chatting with him and talking about the issues. But this stuff about crime in the cities is a real problem, to say the least. Thank you for listening. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we'll talk to you later.